and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing pressure on Nancy Pelosi from her caucus to initiate impeachment hearings, which she is resisting, while Trump himself appears to be acting like Clint Eastwood, taunting the Democrats to go ahead and make my day, as he defies subpoenas, tampers with witnesses, and plays hardball by refusing to even recognize Congress's role of oversight. John Lawrence, a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington Center, who served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's chief of staff, joins us to discuss his article at The Hill, After Mueller, Democrats Need to Avoid the Javert Trap, and tensions that erupted in Monday night's leadership meeting with internal sparring among some senior Democrats and Speaker Pelosi. We will assess whether the impeachment train has left the station, since there is so much frustration at the grassroots and among the Progressive Caucus and the party's base that the Speaker will no longer be able to restrain the passions of her rank and file. And in the face of Trump's insults and taunts and his flagrant contempt towards the Article I branch, at some point hearings will have to be initiated at the very least to set the legal framework for getting the witness testimony and the documentation that Trump is stonewalling on. Then we will speak with former Democratic Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman, who served on the House Judiciary Committee charged with investigating the Watergate scandal, who prepared articles of impeachment that precipitated the resignation of President Nixon. She joins us to discuss her latest book, The Case for Impeaching Trump, and her article of Just Security, The Nixon Impeachment, A Blueprint for Today, and we will assess how best to educate the American people about what is actually in the Mueller report and get the witnesses Trump does not want to testify before a national television audience. Then finally, we'll examine today's hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee, understanding the digital advertising ecosystem and the impact of data privacy and competition policy, and speak with David Carroll, a professor of media design at the New School, where his research examines major shifts in media as it relates to advertising, ad tech, data rights, privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism. He joins us to discuss how the Trump campaign, which used social media successfully in 2016, is way ahead of the Democrats in buying Facebook ads for 2020, helped in part by the crowded Democratic field competing against each other. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is John Lawrence, a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington Center, who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's chief of staff. His latest book is The Class of 74, Congress After Watergate and the Roots of Partisanship. And he has an article at The Hill, After Mueller, Democrats Need to Avoid the Javert Trap. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Lawrence.
Good to be with you again, Ian.
Well, thank you, John. And just to touch on your article, The Javert Trap, of course, you're speaking about Les Miserables and the zealous inspector, right? And is that your analogy there, that you don't want the Democrats to look like they're obsessed with getting Trump?
I think, yeah, the Democrats have to be careful that they don't look like they're so obsessed with the with a partisan pursuit of President Trump that they ignore the other issues that voters elected this Democratic majority in the House to pursue, whether that's health care or economic reform, tax reform, immigration policy, a whole litany of issues which are not only important from the standpoint of establishing a Democratic agenda, but I think are very important in terms of appealing to that less partisan group of voters who switched parties in 2018, who voted for Democrats and thereby gave Democrats the majority. There's a temptation here, of course, because of the very, very strong feelings of many members of the House and many members of the Democratic base to focus exclusively or largely on Trump. And I think they have to withstand that temptation to some extent and be able to demonstrate an ability to govern as well.
Well, there was a very apparently testy meeting at the leadership meeting on Monday night with the House caucus where Nancy Pelosi, some of the senior members like David Cicilline of Rhode Island and others, really pushing hard for impeachment and basically arguing that the only, you know, because the Mueller report's been bottled up by Trump, Barr's done his job, the American people haven't been educated about what's actually in it, and he's playing Stonewall. And in fact, you could make the case that Trump is being Clint Eastwood. He's more or less saying to the Democrats, go ahead and make my day, impeach me. So he's almost taunting them to impeach him. Isn't that pretty clear?
I think it's unquestionably true. I think that Speaker Pelosi recognizes that the president has adopted a strategy unlike anybody since Richard Nixon, when he refused to cooperate with the Watergate investigation, refused to turn the tapes over, and of course was overruled 9-0 by the Supreme Court yesterday. President Trump lost a very important court case where he was refusing to turn over Treasury records to the Congress. I think there's an important change that's taken place in the last couple of weeks here. I think that for a long time, the Democrats and Trump critics in general were pursuing the issue of collusion with Russia, the findings of the Mueller investigation, questions about the president's financial dealings potentially with Russia potential tax troubles, and those were the subjects of potential investigation. I think what's happened more recently, and in some ways presents a very different challenge, is that the issue is now shifted to one of obstruction of the investigation. It's not so much obstruction of justice through the Mueller report as much as it is a willful obstruction by the executive branch of Congress's ability to conduct its constitutional responsibilities. And I think that becomes a tougher and tougher investigation and potential source of action around impeachment for the Speaker and for Democrats to resist.
So he's playing hardball. He's basically saying, you're not going to get a damn thing out of me. That is clear. Nobody's ever behaved like this. And he's absolutely showing contempt for the Article I branch. What other mechanisms are there to educate the American people about what this character has done, which is in the Mueller report, and he's not even allowing the fully unredacted report out? So isn't impeachment, therefore, a mechanism to do the education process that's necessary for the American people to understand what their president has done and his criminal behavior, which is all there in the Mueller report?
Yeah, well, of course, I think that the Mueller report, to some extent, can end up becoming less salient here than the president's ongoing obstruction, whether it's the obstruction of the investigation of the Mueller report, or it's obstruction of tax policy, or it's obstruction across the board. This decision by the president to refuse to cooperate with the Congress runs counter to tradition, it runs counter to the Constitution, and it runs counter to a bipartisan agreement on the part of the Congress, really over the last 40 years, that the Congress must have access to executive officials and to decision-making by the executive branch. So I think this really elevates the issue in a way that if there was a disagreement, for example, over policy, or even over the Mueller report, which would may be looked upon as partisan, there is nothing partisan here about the president's refusal to comply with the congressional subpoena. And I think that does present a very different challenge and potentially a very different problem for anybody who is arguing that we should not go down the impeachment route. And frankly, I've not been one who's been arguing to do that. But if the president will not comply with investigations that are the Congress's responsibility and the Congress's power to look into executive branch behavior, you sort of start running out of other options.
Well, it's my sense that Donald Trump is very savvy and he's very feral in the way that he's actually playing a pretty good game in terms of strategy. And you have to admit that Democrats are somewhat on the defensive. But I think what motivates him, being a reality TV guy, is he's concerned about what happened with Michael Cohen, where public television testimony is so damaging. People that have seen this man on the inside, apparently if you spend a couple of minutes with him, you realize the guy's completely off the wall. And I won't use any psychological diagnosis, but he apparently is out of control. So that's what gets under his skin. When somebody can, like Michael Cohen, can say who this man really is and what makes him tick and what he's likely to do. The same would be true of Don McGahn. The same would be true to some extent of the special counsel who's refusing to testify, apparently now, Mueller himself. Isn't that what's going on here? Trump knows he doesn't care about what they say in depositions, but he sure as hell doesn't want them appearing on television.
He doesn't want them appearing in television. He doesn't want them appearing before Congress, where they're going to have to answer questions. They if they're subpoenaed by the Congress, and we've now seen McGahn and we've seen the Treasury Secretary refuse to either appear or to provide witnesses or information that's been subpoenaed by the Congress. The president is playing a very, very dangerous game. I think that his notion is that he will, as he has always done, use the courts to delay and to try to develop sympathy for his own position. But where he, I think, is may very well run afoul of public opinion is you can have an argument over technicalities, legal. Did the president obstruct the Russia investigation? Did he engage in collusion with Russia? Did he sanction the use of illegal tactics in the campaign? Those are legal points that you would have to argue out in court. It's much easier, it seems to me, for Democrats to argue, look, the president is refusing to engage in, agree with and to comply with lawful congressional investigations, and that in and of itself is an impeachable offense. You have to prove right and wrong. You don't have to prove the fine points of law. Either you allow people to testify or you don't. You either provide subpoena documents or you don't. And I think that's for the president. It may appear to be a strong hand because he is simply saying no, but it may actually be a weak hand because there's much less to argue about if the question comes down to did you comply with the subpoena or you didn't. That's a lot different proving that, and it's a lot simpler to prove that than it is to prove something like collusion with Russia during the campaign.
Well,
so
John,
it could backfire.
Sure. Well, just let's just play a clip that's gone viral of Jeff Daniels on Nicole Wallace's show on MSNBC. He's playing Atticus Finch on Broadway in To Kill a Mockingbird, and he made some very powerful statements.
That's what I see when I look at Trump's rallies. That's when I see the lies spewing at these people and people going, I got to believe in something. And he said he'd bring my manufacturing job back and she didn't. And I'm all in. But at the end of the day, aside from, yeah, I don't want to pay taxes. It's race. It's race. This is about the Republican Party or a wing of it. Going, this is our last chance to save the party. And if we don't, it's the end of the Republican Party. And the only way they can do that was to tap the race button and say, go ahead, it's okay. And he did. And they did. And that was the only card they had left to play, and they played it. And they aren't going to go quietly. And that's why you look at the cowardice of the 15 or so Republicans in the Senate who are still quiet. And I'm not talking about Bob Corker and Jeff Flake and who's the other one that went out the back door.
Yeah.
You know, that's not courage. That's not courage. That's making sure you've got a job somewhere after politics. Courage is standing up and being a true patriot like we used to have way back in 1776 and all of that. We need some. Who are the heroes going to be? Is it going to be the Daniel Ellsberg Pentagon Papers guy? Who's the guy the Justice Department is going to go, here, Washington Post, here's the unredacted, go. I'm waiting for that guy.
We're all waiting for that guy.
We need people like that. And to look at Congress with all their politics going, well, if I do this, I can't do that. You're all worthless to me right now. You are all worthless. I need people to stand up and be heroic. Who are you? Because democracy is at stake.
We've been listening to a clip of Jeff Daniels, who's playing Atticus Fitch on Broadway at the moment. John Lawrence, he made a very passionate appeal for somebody to stand up. The grassroots are very angry, particularly on the Democratic side. What can the Congress do in the face of a mob boss who's just in their face and basically treating them with contempt? Can you arrest him?
Oh, I don't think we're going to find ourselves at that stage. But I think what the speaker has been trying to do is to put her confidence in the committee chairs, and let them walk through the process. I think ideally that would have been to allow the committee chairs to hold hearings, to get testimony on the record, to get access to proprietary information, whether that be tax records or other records, and let the committee develop that bill of particulars. Because I think what her goal is not to delay action. Her goal is to allow the country to see the range of abuses that have occurred so that a consensus can develop in support of taking tough action, if that's warranted. I think that to the extent to which these committees continue to try to do this and they are thwarted, and the public sees day after day, committee after committee, an empty chair where there's supposed to be a subpoenaed witness. I mean, remember, these witnesses are subpoenaed by the Congress. They weren't sent an invitation to a birthday party. They were sent a subpoena, and they're defying these subpoenas. I think that is going to be perceived as building the case. That's why I say this could all backfire on the president, because he's taking what is a complex issue in terms of the Mueller report and collusion and potential illegal activities on tax policy, and reducing it down to a very simplistic issue, and that is obstructing the Congress's investigative authority. And on that point, there can't be a lot of disagreement. Obviously, a subpoena is issued, it's a legal subpoena, and they're refusing to comply. And I think that's one of the reasons why you saw Congressman Amash from Michigan, a Republican, come out and make the statement he did over the weekend that the president appears to have committed impeachable offenses. And it will become, I think, increasingly difficult for members of Congress and members of these committees to simply say, when a president refuses a lawful request of the Congress with impunity and will not send witnesses, will not comply with subpoenas for documentation, you're left with very, very little in the way of response other than to say, well, that looks to me like an impeachable offense. I don't think that's where Mrs. Pelosi wants to go, but I think the president is backing her into it. As you intimated earlier, I think he's doing that on purpose. He wants to make himself a victim. He wants to rally his supporters. But I think it becomes harder and harder for people to defend what he's doing when he so clearly is just blowing off the legislative branch of government.
Well, John Lawrence, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much, Ian. It's good to talk with you again.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with John Lawrence, who's a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington Center, who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's chief of staff. His latest book is The Class of 74, Congress After Watergate and the Roots of Partisanship. And he has an article at The Hill, After Mueller, Democrats Need to Avoid the Javert Trap. We can take a brief station break. We're back speaking with Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman, who served on the House Judiciary Committee charged with investigating the Watergate scandal, who prepared articles of impeachment that precipitated the resignation of President Nixon. We're talking about her new book, The Case for Impeaching Trump. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Elizabeth Holtzman, a lawyer and political leader who is a Democratic congresswoman from New York. She served on the House Judiciary Committee charged with investigating the Watergate scandal and prepared articles of impeachment that precipitated the resignation of President Nixon. Later, she became District Attorney of Brooklyn, New York, where she prosecuted major crimes, including those political and organized. And she's the co-author of three books, including The Impeachment of George W. Bush, Who Said It Would Be Easy, and Cheating Justice. And her latest book is The Case for Impeaching Trump. And she has an article at Just Security, The Nixon Impeachment, A Blueprint for Today. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Holtzman.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you and your listeners.
Well, thank you. And there was a leadership meeting on Monday night at which Nancy Pelosi, apparently some senior members of the Democratic caucus, are pushing for impeachment. David Cicilline, Jamie Raskin, and others. She seems to be holding the line, but you can see that the pressure is mounting. And Donald Trump, in fact, is acting a bit like Clint Eastwood, go ahead and make my day. He's sort of taunting the Democrats to impeach him by being such a thug, effectively, like a mob boss. He's saying, you're not going to get a damn thing from me. So how do you see this thing working out?
Well, I think the stonewalling on documents and on witnesses is only the latest manifestation of serious abuses of power engaged in by Donald Trump. And what I think is really critical is that we've had this Mueller report, which spells out serious and grave misconduct by the president. Very few people have read it. It's 440 pages. I read it. It took a long time. But most Americans haven't read it. And there's so many facts, and they're so varied. The narrative is not clearly out there for them. Someone has to tell the story succinctly to the American people, and they have to see the people who are the witnesses. They need to see Don McGahn. They need to see Michael Flynn. They need to see Michael Cohen about some of the other issues. They need to see other witnesses. That hasn't really happened. Michael Cohen is the only one who's appeared in public. The rest of them have been all behind closed doors. So we need to have an airing of the facts. That's what happened. I mean, I go back to what happened during Watergate. We didn't start with an impeachment inquiry. We started with the Senate Select Watergate Committee. It was chaired by the crusty old senator from North Carolina, constitutional scholar, who wanted to get the facts out to the American people. That's what started it. That's where John Dean, the White House counsel, testified. That's where the top aides to Nixon testified. The American people got a great sense of what the actual facts were and the trustworthiness and sincerity and truthfulness of the various witnesses. That was critical. We haven't had that. Then, after the Saturday night massacre and Nixon fired or ordered the firing of the special Watergate prosecutor, the American people demanded that Congress act. They didn't demand that Congress act for impeachment. They said, Congress, you've got to hold the president accountable. I think the American people, a lot of Americans, I mean, we're very close to half of the American people, want to see Congress hold President Trump accountable. Congress has to do something about it. They need to create a narrative of the facts that are in the Mueller report. They have to set those facts out clearly to the American people, and they have to start, and I think the time is getting very close, they have to start an impeachment inquiry. That doesn't mean the president is going to be impeached at the end of it. When we started our impeachment inquiry, and I, by the way, voted for the impeachment of Richard Nixon, and the committee voted three articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon. When we started the process, we didn't have an end point in mind. We didn't know that we were going to be able to impeach Richard Nixon. We didn't even know what the Constitution provided. We didn't know what the full facts were. We didn't know what the whole case was. So it was a gathering of information process, ultimately brought all the Democrats on the committee and more than 30% of the Republicans on the committee to the decision that Nixon had engaged in high crimes and misdemeanors, had committed them, and was therefore impeachable. And the results of the committee's efforts were so fair and based on such solid evidence and so bipartisan that the American people fully supported what the committee did, and Nixon was forced to resign. So we didn't start out saying, we're going to impeach the guy. We couldn't have said that. We started out saying, what's the constitutional standard? What are the facts? And how do they work together? And is there a case?
And again, I'm speaking with former Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman, who served on the House Judiciary Committee charged with investigating the Watergate scandal and prepared the articles of impeachment that precipitated the resignation of President Nixon. Her latest book is The Case for Impeaching Trump, and she has an article at Just Security, The Nixon Impeachment, A Blueprint for Today. So having made the case, Elizabeth Holtzman, that this is an educational process, if you will, and the public have not been educated by the Mueller report because William Barr, in collusion with Donald Trump, have blunted its impact, and the president himself, of course, is not making the full unredacted copy of the report available to the public or the Congress. So if we are in a situation where you have this president who has a sort of kind of feral sense of self-preservation and is willing to go to the max and go to the mat, does that mean that given the obstruction that's going on now and the stonewalling, if you start an impeachment inquiry, and I'm not sure what the difference between going ahead with impeachment and an impeachment inquiry, but what is the legal framework, in other words, to stop the stonewalling so that you can actually get witnesses and get documents from the administration?
Look, part of our constitutional structure depends on good faith adherence to the law. People want to be systematic and systemic lawbreakers. It's very hard to deal with them in the normal fashion. Normally, witnesses appear before Congress. It's almost unheard of for a witness to refuse to appear. So I want to go back to the framework. When we started our impeachment inquiry, it was kind of informal. We learned about the Constitution. We learned about British legal history, parliamentary history. But we didn't actually formally get authorization until February 1974. And then it came in a resolution by the House of Representatives authorizing us to commence an inquiry into whether sufficient grounds existed for the impeachment of Richard Nixon. That's what it is. So that when people say, I want him impeached, that's not going to happen without a process. Just like a trial. I want him, lock her up. We don't behave that way. You have to have a trial before you lock somebody up. You can't just say lock her up or impeach him. It can't happen and shouldn't happen that way. You need to have a deliberative process. What's happening now is that Trump is trying to stonewall that process, obstruct that process, and stymie that process from going forward. Why is he doing that? Because he is the master, the champion of reality TV, and he knows the power of reality TV, and reality TV is having the witnesses against him appear before the American people, and he is terrified of that. That's what's going on now. This is a huge cover-up. What can Congress do? Nixon refused to turn over information to our committee. He stonewalled us, too. He told the American people, I've turned over all this information, but the information turned out to be falsified, doctored, faked up, and there were just documents he refused to give us, just refused. So that was one of the articles of impeachment. We were not able to get all the documents we needed. And it may be that Congress can't get all the documents it needs, but what it needs to do is send the president a clear message that his behavior is intolerable, and the stonewalling about the documents is also, as it was in the Nixon case, about criminality. Let's make it very clear, and let's get a clear picture. What we're talking about here, what the Mueller report is about, is likely criminal conduct by the President of the United States of America. We have someone in the White House who is likely a criminal. What are we going to do about it? And it's not Liz Holtzman who's saying it. It's not Nancy Pelosi who's saying it. It's Robert Mueller's report. The American people have to understand, what are the charges made in that report? Even though Mueller doesn't call them charges. But he sets it out so that there are potential charges of a criminal nature against him. You don't need to commit a crime for impeachment, but it helps to show the gravity of what he did. So I think we have to get that report. We have to have a process. American people have to be educated about what's in the report. They have to be educated about what the possible charges could be. I set them out in my book. But this is very serious now. The question of what kind of democracy we're going to have is really at stake here. Congress has two ways to get the documents. It can either ultimately vote to impeach the president for not giving them documents, but that was not the strongest ground that we had support for when we had our three articles of impeachment. One of those articles was the refusal to provide the committee, Judiciary Committee, with documents. That was got the fewest number of votes. So that's not going to be the biggest argument. And people are going to want to know, what were the abuses of power that he engaged in? Why did he do these? What was it that he did that was bad, and why did he do them? And that seems to me is really a requirement for Congress to do right now. And it's critical, because if we don't do that, we allow someone who's basically been described as possibly likely having committed crimes, federal crimes, sitting in the White House, and nothing happens, that's very bad. Congress can try to impeach the president for this, or they can try, and I think they should do that, and go to court and seek court rulings. I mean, ultimately, that's what happened in Watergate. The most telltale tape recording was released after the special prosecutor went to court to get it from the president, who didn't want to turn it over for obvious reasons because it was incriminating. So we have a cover-up going on. How do we fight a cover-up? We try to use the courts. We try to use the constitutional process, which is given to the Congress to preserve the democracy, the impeachment process. But that has to be started without saying, oh, well, we're going to impeach him right away. You have to go through a process, determine the facts, determine the law, let the American people understand the issues, and then move forward, assuming that the case can be made.
Well, I think you're absolutely right on the money, Elizabeth Holtzman, that Trump, as a reality TV man, understands the damage that the public testimony of Michael Cohen did to him. He doesn't care about depositions and how many hours Don McGahn spoke to the special counsel, and as we've mentioned, they've managed to bottle up the report and obfuscate it, and the public have not really understood what's actually in the Mueller report. So what do you make then of the dilemma that apparently Nancy Pelosi has, that she wants to get the Democratic agenda out there and run on that as opposed to run on impeachment?
Okay, so Nancy's concerns, or I should say Speaker Pelosi's concerns, are very legitimate, and they actually echo the concerns that existed during Watergate. The Senate Watergate Committee in the spring of 1974 held hearings where John Dean testified and said, I told the president that there was a cancer on the presidency, that hush money was being paid to the Watergate burglars to keep them from cooperating with the prosecutor, that presidential pardons were being dangled in front of the burglars to keep them from cooperating with the prosecutor. And the president said, according to Dean, I know where we can get hush money. You know, basically it's not a problem. Well, that was really the starting point. And I think it's really, really, really important for the American people to see those facts, the same kinds of facts, in the same kind of way. You need to see the televising of these facts and then go forward. But after despite the Senate Watergate Committee hearings, the House of Representatives did nothing. The speakers and the majority leader never said, oh, we're doing nothing. They just did nothing. And it was clear that they were going to do nothing, despite all the revelations of the Senate, until the Saturday Night Massacre. When the Saturday Night Massacre happened, the American people rose up and said, we are not a banana republic, and the president can't pick his prosecutor, and we're going to have due process in this country. then the House acquiesced. So I can understand her caution. That's exactly what happened in Watergate. They said no, 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 till they couldn't say no anymore because the American people demanded action. So, but the other thing I think is that Nancy, the Speaker Pelosi, and many Democrats and people in the press keep thinking about the Clinton impeachment. The Clinton impeachment was a flawed impeachment. It was totally partisan. It was began with the recommendation of a special prosecutor, not with the feelings of the American people. The American people never supported it. And the charges, while they showed reprehensible conduct on Clinton's part, the charges never showed the kind of threat to our democracy that you had in Watergate. If you go back to Watergate, you see that the impeachment process was handled fairly, had public support all the way through, had vast public support when we finished. Nixon resigned because he knew he was going to be convicted in the Senate, and Nixon was forever disgraced. The consequences of that, of the impeachment inquiry, were to build huge public support for preserving our democracy. The country wasn't divided. It was united. We on the House Judiciary Committee did the impeachment work, but the rest of the House of Representatives did their work. I know that because not only did I have to do the work on the House Judiciary Committee, but I had to do all the rest of my work as a member of Congress. So, you know, the House of Representatives was able to chew gum and walk at the same time. That can happen again. The agenda of the House is really important. But the House Judiciary Committee or whatever committee is given the responsibility can conduct the impeachment inquiry without interfering with the normal business of the House of Representatives. That's how it happened in Watergate, and that's how it could happen again. And we need to look at that. That's why I wrote that article. We need to look at Watergate as a blueprint. It has some very important lessons for us now.
Given that you had a Democratic House and Senate back in the days of Watergate, and you've got Mitch McConnell controlling the Senate, what would happen if you made the case, and the best possible case, and it's out there. In fact, you could even go back before Mueller's writ and look into the extraordinary history of Donald Trump laundering Russian money through his properties. It's an extraordinary story of how this man has been one step ahead of the sheriff all his professional life. But nevertheless, isn't it possible that you could make a great case and Mitch McConnell would simply just, it would be dead on arrival in his chamber?
It's possible, but let me just tell you what happened during Watergate. People changed their minds because of the facts, and people changed their minds because of the American people for two reasons. I'll give you the best example. When the Select Committee on Watergate began, it had Sam Ervin, who was the Democratic chair, and it had Howard Baker, who was the Republican conservative vice chair. And Baker was a complete partisan of the president. He said this whole investigation is a witch hunt, talking about Watergate. He said it's all ridiculous, it's a waste of time, it's absurd. That's what he said, starting out. And he said, I'm going to come up with these questions that are going to prove that the president is innocent. What were his questions? What did the president know, and when did he know it? Those became famous questions. Those questions were developed for the purpose of proving that Nixon was innocent. Guess what? When those questions got asked and the witnesses started saying, well, you know, the president knew this and the president knew that and the president was involved here and the president was involved there, Baker changed his mind. He said, well, let's get the facts wherever they take us. Now, he was a conservative Republican. He started as a total partisan for the White House. On the House Judiciary Committee, we had about a third of the Republicans support two articles of impeachment, and all the Southern Democrats, whose districts were probably even more pro-Nixon than some of the Republicans' districts. I don't know that they started out all believing that Nixon should be impeached. I think they took time to understand what the facts were. Some of them might have been partisans for Nixon, just the way Howard Baker was. It wouldn't be surprising to me. So I'm not saying we have to all start out and assume that just because somebody at the outset thinks that the president has done nothing wrong, that they're not going to change their minds. They might not. But we have a very good example with regard to Howard Baker, somebody who did change his mind. And I think that so he changed his mind because of the facts. But the American people also, because of their concern for having a government that obeyed the rule of law, also changed the minds and affected the determination of people on the House Judiciary Committee. Some people are running for re-election in the Senate. They have to face their constituents. If the evidence is strong, if the process is fair, if it's not, doesn't look like it's a partisan gotcha effort, but it looks fair, dignified, sensible, and based on solid evidence, you can persuade a lot of Americans. Remember, Nixon won with a landslide, one of the biggest in American history, and Trump only won squeaks through. He lost the popular vote. Nixon won the popular vote in the landslide and the Electoral College. We don't have to change a lot of minds, but if the American people feel that the process is fair, they will support it, I believe, and that will also affect the Senate. Will it produce 67 votes in the Senate? I have no idea. I don't even know, you know, what the final case will look like. But I do know that the process has to be done, not the way it was done in the Clinton impeachment, and that's why I'm urging the leadership in the House to think past the Clinton impeachment. But if it's done the way it was done during Watergate, in a deliberate, fair, judicial, honorable way, it can win the support of many American people. They do not want someone in the White House who has broken the law repeatedly, who has defied the Constitution, who has abused the power of his office, but they don't understand what the facts are, and they've been hidden. Partly it's because the Republicans controlled the Congress in the last 2 years, and they held all the hearings, just about all the hearings, behind closed doors. They knew what they were doing. It was to shield the truth from the American people, hide the truth from the American people. But we need to change that.
Well, just in closing, Elizabeth Holtzman, you mentioned the Saturday night massacre being a turning point, particularly for the recalcitrant Republicans. We have a president who pushes the envelope almost every day in ways that we have never seen such a crude discourse and such bad behavior by a president. What will it take? Do you see a breaking point, or do you think it's just an cumulative educational exercise that's necessary here to educate the public about the need for impeachment, which is what your book's really about?
Yeah, well, right. I mean, I don't think everything can duplicate Watergate, but I think we can learn a lot of lessons from Watergate. I don't know that you need to have a dramatic event like the firing of the special prosecutor, but I think the refusal of the President of the United States to allow witnesses to come before the Congress to answer questions about whether the President committed a crime as President in the Oval Office, that is something that the American people have to be told is what is going on, and let them help to decide whether Congress ought to be looking at this or not. And I think this stonewalling, and I don't want to call it just stonewalling, covering up the question of whether the president himself engaged in criminal conduct is very serious. And I don't think Americans want someone who's covering up criminality in the White House as president.
Well, Elizabeth Holtzman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Holtzman, who's a lawyer and political leader, who was a Democratic congresswoman from New York. She served on the House Judiciary Committee charged with investigating the Watergate scandal and prepared articles of impeachment that precipitated the resignation of President Nixon. Later, she became District Attorney of Brooklyn, New York, where she prosecuted major crimes, including those political and organized. She's the co-author of three books, including The Impeachment of George W. Bush, Who Said It Would Be Easy, and Cheating Justice. And her latest book is The Case for Impeaching Trump. And she has an article, Just Security, The Nixon Impeachment, A Blueprint for Today. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the Trump campaign, which used social media successfully in 2016, is way ahead of the Democrats in buying Facebook ads for 2020, helped in part by the crowded Democratic field competing against each other. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Carroll, a professor of media design at the New School, where he explores the intersections between media design, culture, policy, industry, and education. His research and analysis examines major shifts in media as it relates to advertising, ad tech, data rights, privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Carroll.
Great to be on. Thank you, Ian.
Well, thank you. And the hearings today before the Senate Judiciary Committee, chaired by Lindsey Graham, the hearing was called Understanding the Digital Advertising Ecosystem and the Impact of Data Privacy and Competition Policy. It sounds rather dry, but it was very interesting. And for once, they didn't have a bunch of tech titans like Zuckerberg dissembling and basically denying their monopolistic powers and malignancy. They had some independent analysts, and it did, to some extent, the conversation did, or the questioning did, turn to the current political campaigns for president, where you have 22 Democrats running against one Republican. So we're learning that the Trump campaign is outspending Democrats on Facebook. So let's start with what was discussed in terms of the impact of digital media in politics and how, in effect, the politicians are catching up with the technology.
Sure, yes. One of the things that I appreciated about this particular hearing was that the lawmakers were sounding much savvier than they were in prior hearings. I think they are catching up with how the technology works and starting to ask more informed questions. The industry is really difficult to understand, so you really can't blame the lawmakers for as much as the critique as they have received for asking what sound like dumb questions. But one of the things that was discussed in today's hearing was the idea that because the prices for digital ad placements are set by real-time auctions, the price is really set by just supply and demand. And so when lawmakers asked, could a platform put its finger on the scale in favor of one candidate from one party over another, the discussion sort of dealt with the reality that it's already that way because of the auction pricing. So when we look at the spending of Trump versus the more than 20 Democratic candidates for president, we can just see right there that the auction dynamic is going to make the money that the Trump campaign is spending go much farther per impression, basically, than all the other candidates who are basically competing for the same eyeballs. So there's a lot more competition for the smaller slice of the demographic. So Facebook actually released some data about the sort of average price per ad when it was Trump versus Hillary Clinton. And we got to see a little of this dynamic at play there, that voters in urban areas were like more expensive than voters in rural ones. So that advantaged Trump. So it was good to see the lawmakers start to grasp the idea of the real-time auction system that runs the digital ad industry.
Well, there's no question that the Trump administration, or at least the Trump campaign, got a jump on the Democrats in the 2016 campaign and on Hillary Clinton specifically. There was some crowing on the part of Brad Parscale, the guy that ran the campaign, and he in a 60 Minutes interview that he did, he basically said, well, you know, Facebook were working with us directly with the Trump campaign, but they offered to work with the Hillary campaign, and they were turned down. I don't know whether that's true or not, but that's why I think this hearing's important and this issue is important. So what's your sense of the role that it played in 2016 and it could play in 2020?
So in certain ways, Trump and Facebook are made for each other. They are perfectly optimized for each other's business model. That is, Trump harvests data about his supporters and sells them merchandise and gets them to donate small amounts, and that contributes towards their loyalty in the polling booth and other places. And Facebook is a perfect engine for the data collection, the marketing, and the micro-targeting. So the fact that, you know, you can upload email addresses and other personal information directly into Facebook and target those voters one-on-one, the whole campaign model of Brad Parscale is perfect for that. Whereas the Democrats, you know, aren't necessarily advantaged the same way, because their campaigns are not necessarily built on selling merchandise and micro-targeting the very same people that were deeply micro-targeted in 2016. So the new candidates are figuring out who their voters are, whereas Trump knows exactly who their voters are. It's the same people that keep on ordering hats, going to rallies, and giving small donations.
And again, I'm speaking with David Carroll, who's a professor of media design at the New School, where he explores the intersection between media design, culture, policy, industry, and education. And his research and analysis examines major shifts in media as it relates to advertising, ad tech, data rights, privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism. And of course, this micro-targeting, which has become a contentious issue, and it was something that the special prosecutor Mueller was looking into, although we don't really know, because the report's been bottled up, at least the full report. But it does look as if there was a link that they were trying to explore between Manafort meeting with his GRU assistant, Kilimnik, handing over polling on, particularly on these important three states that Trump won in order to win the Electoral College, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And by the way, Trump's been campaigning quite a lot in Pennsylvania just a couple of nights ago. So what's your sense of that link, that it looks as though the Russian troll factory helped, they got the data who to target, and then they went ahead and targeted them with these divisive ads?
Sure. Yes. In volume one of the Mueller report, there are several incredible scenarios, you know, clearly outlined that are not redacted. And one of them is, as you describe, the idea that Rick Gates suspected Kilimnik was a spy. He was instructed by Manafort to give polling data on a weekly basis over WhatsApp. They knew that if it was going to Kilimnik, it would make its way to Deripaska and then beyond. And then when Manafort left the campaign, Rick Gates started sending much less voter polling data to Kilimnik so that it was less valuable. And so the idea that he was worried that he was sharing data with a spy, and then when Manafort left the campaign, he changed his behavior accordingly, I think is a stunning detail that hasn't really gotten a lot of attention, but really shows that there were, you know, that information was passing through intermediaries over, you know, unofficial channels like WhatsApp. And that should be really concerning to understand that campaigns were actively sharing sensitive proprietary information like that. And what's also interesting is that the campaign's internal polling was finding early on that these battleground states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, was finding that out too. So you can go back and you can find articles during the campaign where people from Cambridge Analytica were talking about their strategy, and they were saying that, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania are battleground states for us. That's what our data is showing. And what that's just showing is, yeah, those really were the battleground states. The campaign was going to find those were the places where there were districts that had persuadable voters. A lot of those were voters who previously voted for Obama and switched to Trump. Those were decisive voters, and the campaign polling data was identifying who they were. So I think it is an unanswered question, what was the relationship between the campaign and the data that was flowing through Kilimnik that might be in the further redacted areas. Certainly in the Senate judiciary sent a letter to Chair Lindsey Graham listing their unanswered questions, the questions they'd like to ask Robert Mueller if he was able to come in. And one of the questions is this from the other members is, you know, was the campaign's firm investigated by the special counsel? What did they find? Was there any relationship that was uncovered there? And what were the relationships to WikiLeaks and so on? So these are all still unanswered questions. And it's part of the story that I think still needs to be unraveled moving forward as the grander narrative is tied up as people continue to process the Mueller report, both of Volume 1 and Volume 2, and the different implications that are contained in both the volumes.
Yeah, but of course, very few people are doing what you just said, David. That's the problem. That's why Barr has been so successful in blunting its impact. Very few Americans have actually read the report. And one Republican congressman who read it actually was moved to call for Trump's impeachment, and now he's being ostracized. But what I think is key to this flow of information from Manafort to Kilimnik on to Deripaska. Deripaska then, of course, turned it over to Prigozhin, who ran the Internet Research Agency, the IRA, and the troll factory in St. Petersburg, and they were sending stuff to those, targeting those people in those particularly important three swing states, encouraging Democrats to vote for Jill Stein, for example, who got more votes in those three states than Hillary Clinton lost by. So that was a very successful operation. Prigozhin's shop has come up against the IRA, the Internet Research Agency, in a story that's out now about Jay Aslanov, who's one of the 13 Russians indicted by Mueller. He's apparently involved in this story of how the Russians, at least it was something that was being discussed, whether it was acted upon, of course, is another matter, that they tried, the Russians were trying to sow unrest in the U.S. beyond the 2016 and even into the 2020 elections with the idea of one of their plans was to find a bunch of African-American radicals in this country, send them off to Africa, train them in ideology and demolition, et cetera, and have them come back to the United States and blow up whatever and cause mayhem. It's a bit far-fetched. I'm certainly going to look into that, see if we can pin it down a little bit more. But again, it does indicate the kind of mischief that Prigozhin has been up to and is still up to.
Yes, it's interesting document that surfaced that would be great to get further verified, but it certainly fits the pattern of how these operations work as sort of commercial intermediaries that work on behalf of political actors. And so therefore, since they're commercial entities, this Internet Research Agency, it just seems like a regular company that then they operate by, you know, conducting normal business, even though it's for political purposes. And so the pitches themselves have been surfacing, and we've noticed that these pitches have surfaced in the aftermath of the 2016 election in a lot of different contexts and point to all different kinds of ways that we're lifting the veil on the sort of dark arts of elections around the world. So whether it's pitches that have surfaced related to Cambridge Analytica's alleged work for the UKIP and Leave campaigns, whether it's pitches that have surfaced from Psy Group, the Israeli sort of troll factory that were pitched to Rick Gates of the Trump campaign, offering fake accounts and fake news amplified by those accounts. And we've seen other pitches of offerings. And what's, you know, tantalizing about these pitches is that they seem to verify our worst fears that you know, campaigns are actively engaged in the same tactics that we accuse the Internet Research Agency of undertaking. But of course, the pitches are themselves instruments of plausible deniability, because then they can say, well, we never followed through on any of these things. So it creates a lot of uncertainty. And so that's another reason why the Mueller investigation is so important to us, because it gives us some legal fact finding that we all really need to figure out what happened and how we can protect democracy and elections moving forward.
So just in the last couple of minutes, David Carroll, back to the spending by Trump, who's outspending the Democrats on Facebook. And I imagine there are other money being spent on social media, although Facebook clearly is a monopoly. Apparently, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are catching up. But that sort of indicates, doesn't it, a disadvantage going forward, just in terms of fundraising, when you've got 22 Democrats running against each other. Aren't they slicing up the fundraising pie, whereas Trump's got a free pass?
Yes. The primary will be a fierce fight, because not only are the candidates fighting for the same dollars, for campaign dollars from donors, but they're also fighting for the same voter eyeballs on platforms like Facebook, because the auction is pitting them against each other. And the most Facebook's algorithms know the users who are the perfect audiences for these candidates' eyeballs. And the algorithms are matching that up and setting the price accordingly. So scarcity of money and a scarcity of eyeballs is going to create for a very interesting primary dynamic this season, for sure.
Well, David Carroll, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Carroll, who's a professor of media design at the New School, where he explores the intersection between media design, culture, policy, industry, and education. And his research and analysis examines major shifts in media as it relates to advertising, ad tech, data rights, privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates, as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.